Hello, my name is Jen Hickey. Welcome to the WEN podcast, a series of conversations with people as they share their WEN moments. Recognizing these times can change our destiny, help us to stop hiding behind the past or clinging to a future that may or may not happen. This podcast is about recognizing the power of the WEN moments. This week, I'm so excited because I chat to Jerry Crichton from Dublin Zoo. We chat about everything from the fundraising campaign that's happening at the moment to how much the animals eat on a daily basis and also how they've learned how to interact with them on their terms. The zoo has come a long way since Jerry started working there over 36 years ago. This is such a heartwarming conversation and I loved every second of it. I really hope you do too. Please visit dublinzoo.ie to donate. How are you?
I'm good. It's been an absolutely crazy week, but what in a good way.
Sure. Gosh, what a crazy bananas week.
Exactly. It's just gone way, way beyond anything that we expected. You know what I mean? We launched on Wednesday and we were kind of saying, difficult time of the year, November, Christmas, people said it'll probably, if we got a couple of 100,000.
Yeah.
The finish over 2 million is extraordinary. Yeah, so it's wonderful.
Amazing. But I mean, so let's start there. Let's start with, because I know we spoke a few weeks ago and we talked about the fact that, the zoo was in trouble. You haven't had people been able to go for ages. Yes. So what happens in that scenario? Because obviously everything has to run as normal for the animals.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we still have to keep the normal diets, the veterinary care, the habitat care up to normal. And I mean, that equates to 500,000 per month or 17,000 over a day. Like it's extraordinary. It's an extraordinary amount of money that's required. Like if you look at, say, like the likes of our elephants, they would cost, 5,000 a week to feed a herd. The lions, 50 kilos, they'd eat an average of 20 kilos, 30 kilos a go. So that would cost 50, 60, euros per feed.
Christ.
So, and then we bring in all these, specially formulated diets from all over the world. So,
yeah.
And then, of course, this time of the year too, you have the additional expense of heating. You have a lot more heat on than you would have any other time of the year. So it was just, we wouldn't have been able to sustain it. We did have, some reserves kept, of course, based on 2001 when we had the foot and mouth disease. We kind of learned a lesson then. So there was a reserve fund, but with 500,000 a month going out, it wouldn't last too long.
Yeah, I mean, and that, even in saying that, 500,000, so you've got over 2 million. So like you're only talking about 4 months. That's
well,
the reality.
Exactly. But the government did step in as well yesterday and made an announcement that there'll be 1,100,000 shared between Dublin Zoo and FOTA. So that gives us another month. And then we're just really, really hopeful that between the vaccines and what's been formulated around the world that we can get back operational. Because even though we were open for some of the summers, we were only allowed a couple of thousand people in. And in our summer days, a busy day for the zoo would be 10, 11,000 people. So you're way down. So to give you an idea, like last year we had 1,270,000 people visit the zoo. Like this year, if we get back open for December, we'll probably finish around 490,000. So it's huge. It's huge losses. It's huge losses, Jen. And we are a world-class center for excellence. Like the zoo has transformed incredibly since I started as a young boy. From a Victorian zoo with cages and bars to open habitat. Now with that, the animals are immersed in a landscape that's similar to where they come from. Like our Kaziranga Trail represents, a piece of the Kaziranga Trail in India, our African plains, our gorilla habitat. We planted 15,000 plants, 200 different species, all edible for the gorillas in that habitat. It's absolutely magnificent. Natural trees to climb. And so,
Crikey, amazing. And even how do they survive those plants over here?
Is there it's funny, our climate is actually very acceptable, to a lot of, if you go up around our African savanna area, they're all African grasses. And along our Kaziranga Trail, there's actually Himalayan lilies that grow there too. And they only flower once every 10 years. So, our horticultural team are really on top of their job. And if you have the bamboo, of course, which grows very well along the trail, we actually harvest some of that to feed the animals as well. So, you know, it's a real biopark. It's a beautiful, beautiful zoo. Like I say, I travel to many zoos around the US and around Europe and England. And, you know, and I do come back and I say, wow. Like, you know, the way it's designed with the winding pathways, and it's so, you know, really natural growth, and you kind of stumble upon these habitats, so you don't see anything in long distances. Yeah. So it creates a really, really nice visitor, you know, experience. You know, you're really.
Oh, I love going to the zoo. I mean, I've always loved it, but it is, as you say, looking at how it's transformed over the years of when I was a kid. I mean, let's go back a little bit, Jerry. So obviously you're the only person I know that has had the job for as long as you have. I mean, we're talking what? How many years
started? Well, I mean, they start paying me when I was 16 here. And, you know, so I'm over, you know, 36 years now, you know, as a keeper. But, you know, when I was a young boy, like I'm second generation, my dad, obviously, he was a keeper here at the zoo for over 50 years. Wow. When I was a young boy, we lived in Iver Street, which is very close to the zoo. It's down at Dublin 7 there, and I used to come up on the weekends with him, and you know, and I remember very vivid memories as a young boy, like holding my dad's hand and going into the lion house in the morning. People, you know, would remember the lion house in days gone by, and yet these big cats just pacing up and down in these small cages. Unfortunately, we do it differently, but when my dad had opened the door in the morning, the stench of urine and ammonia, and your eyes, you'd be wiping your eyes as the tears would come into your eyes, and then you'd wait for the air to come in and start to dilute some of the smell. Ooh. And these big cats, and I, you know, when he went, and I used to push the meat trolley around, people remember then, like the cats were the sounds and the smell.
And were they tame? Like,
not really, no. Okay. I mean, they were all wild cats, like, and you know, in what was the old Robert's house now, it's our Jurassic area now where we have the reptiles, but there was big cats in there, and my dad looked after the cats there, so it was great. Like, it was brilliant to witness it. You know, thankfully we've much better habitats now, but like the zoo was renowned for its big cats then, believe it or not. Like, you know, even the amount of lions that we bred, all, you know, in them old houses. Like, actually, you know, you remember the MGM lion Calibra, one of them was born here at Dublin Zoo. That was on the MGM movie. So it was the lion industry of the Dublin lion became a very famous export for us because they were big and strong, and a lot of zoos looked for them then. But that was, yeah, that's when I started coming up to the zoo with my dad. And then there was what we call the Pets Corner then. It's now Family Farm. And all the keepers' kids used to hang out there together. And, you know, you'd clean out, you'd learn to, you'd feed the, you know, bottle feed the baby lambs. And
amazing.
You know, brilliant experience. And then we used to hang out together and we get fed for helping to clean around there. And the sense of freedom you had, you thought you were free running around the zoo. But, you know, and all the keepers would look out for each other's kids. And so it was a really, really privileged, you know, to be able to do that.
Yeah,
the zoo was such a, you know, a part of my life from the time I learned to walk. So, you know, and to see the way it's transformed and changed is remarkable. And yeah,
so when did that start happen? Your brother was in the zoo as well, is that right?
My brother James still is, yeah. My brother, okay. James is here, and he met his wife here. Rachel, who's also a keeper. My dad met my mother here. She worked in, wow, the restaurant. And she was saying she remembers him coming up, and he walked over to her carrying a bucket of fish on the way down to feed the sea lions, he said, and the smell off him and the smell off the fish, it wasn't very romantic. But he asked her out for a date, and the rest is history, as
amazing.
They say.
Brilliant.
Yeah, so we have a long family tradition, and you know, within the zoo, and that, there's a couple of keepers here too, like, that their fathers worked here, and it was just a wonderful,
and privilege. Always, the welfare of the animals. So I know it wasn't, you're saying, obviously it was a Victorian type zoo, but still, obviously, the welfare of the animals back then was primary, I'm sure.
Of course. I mean, yeah. The keepers, you know, there's been different philosophies and philosophical changes to how we manage animals now, because we understand their biology a lot better, their social needs, how they group, how they live, how they feed, because we have greater access to knowledge and from biology and ecology and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, like, I mean, the keepers then were very, very experienced, because it was probably more dangerous than it is now in terms, right, of, you know, with health and safety, and you have a lot more. And they were very skilled at what they did. You know, like my dad was a great cat keeper, and, you know, there was all the keepers then in them days, you know, had to do a lot more getting in with animals or getting around them. It's very different now. So they were very, very skilled handlers in terms of you know, nowadays it's a lot more training for, you know, we can train animals positively, like our elephants. I train elephants to allow me to do a pedicure on their feet, to take blood from their draw. Yeah, to take blood from their ears, all on a positive reinforcement basis. So, and I actually travel to zoos all over the world. I'm an elephant care consultant, and I travel to zoos because everybody wants to do it the Dublin way. We've had such a global influence. We have the right social groupings. Our Kaziranga Forest Trail, as I say, we created a piece of India right here. And the elephant gave us the answers. We look at the biology of the animal, how they live, how they sleep, how they feed, and we've replicated that into a 24-hour life cycle. And that's why the zoo is thriving now.
Yeah. God, I mean, so what do you say to, because there are, you know, I love the zoo, I love animals, but for people that are kind of, you know, oh, don't agree with zoos, you know, animals being locked up, all of that. I mean, obviously we need zoos. Animals are endangered.
Absolutely. All the animals, you know, a huge majority of the species we have here are part of international breeding programs. And we're a member of two different organizations. One is called BIAZA, which is the British and Irish Association of Zoos and Aquariums, or EASA, which is the European Association of Zoos and Aquariums. So they're very organized. They're organized breeding programs. Like, for example, if we have Asiatic lion here, less than 400 left in the world now. You know, and you know, without the excellent work that breeding programs that are happening, these would become an extinct species. But you have what they call a stud book keeper, and a stud book keeper would know all the Asian lions that's in the European population, and he would recommend, say, the Dublin male goes to meet the German female. It's a bit like Tinder for lions. And then we send them off, and it's all based on genetics. It's all based on the gene pool.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, there's a science behind it, you know, and this there's over 700 zoos in EASA that meet every year and plan strategies and plan which species need the help and support. So it's very detailed, it's very scientific, you know, and ultimately, I'd love to say one day that there was no need for zoos, but there is no such thing as the wild. You know, I mean, yeah. I've been to the Kaziranga Park in India, and there's railroads going through it. I was there as we stopped the traffic in the evening. We the rangers had told us that the elephants were going to migrate across the road, and we had to stop the traffic to allow the elephants to cross the road to go to feed on the vegetation on the other side of the Kaziranga. And it, like, you know, it kind of really hit home then. And then you were hearing, we went to railroad tracks where elephants had been killed, and, you know, the race for space, the population is so great.
Is poaching massive still?
Poaching is still, like, you know, it's still very, very huge, particularly with the African and the Asian. But they've actually, what's happening now in Asia, a lot of the tusk elephants are not forming tusks now. Okay. They're called muknas, and they don't have tusks. It's kind of like nature's way is coping. So they don't get shot, which, but there still is, like, even at the time that we've been talking, there's probably been two African elephants poached. So, you know.
Oh my God, it's heartbreaking.
That's the reality, Jen. That's what we're facing.
Jeez. Yeah. And what was it like for you? Because you obviously your experience in a zoo. So to be in the wild, that must have been
absolutely breathtaking. We when we go through it and to look at them. But then, you know, it gave me a great sense of satisfaction when I seen how they behave in the wild and what they had access to and how we have replicated it in Dublin Zoo. You know, we take our inspiration from the wild when we're creating habitats for our animals. But, you know, to see the human-elephant conflict that happens daily, and it's a real worry. But yet there was nothing like the first time when I went into Kaziranga, and we were out on our jeep, and a big bull elephant came out from the forest and just maybe it was only 5 or 6 meters away, and, you know, and everything I'd ever wanted to see, like a wild bull elephant in front of me. And then we came around the corner another time, and then we could hear all the like a barking there. You could hear them barking, making out an alarm call. And the guy that was with us, one of the rangers, says, there's a tiger on the move. And right enough, we came around the corner, and there was a big tiger just sitting in the grass, no more than 100 meters away from us. And I was saying, because I love the big cats. And I said, look, and to actually see a tiger.
And what did they do with each other?
No, they just all cohabitate. Like the lion has, or the tiger, I should say, goes after a particular species of deer. He won't go near the elephants. The elephants are too big. But, you know, the Kaziranga has such a vast array of wildlife, buffalo, you know, different species of monkeys. We've seen everything. I couldn't believe the amount of species that we've seen. And you know, it was great because why I was there was Dublin supports a conservation body out there called the Asian Nature Conservation Fund. So I was out there working with the rangers, looking at how our money is spent. You know, we're involved in tracking, radio collaring the elephants to see the distances and to help advise with the human elephant conflict. And so, you know, to see the conservation work that Dublin Zoo is doing in the field made me very, very proud.
And is that still going on even during COVID? Is that able to continue?
Yes. Yeah, it is able to continue. Absolutely. We obviously had to restrict our budgets a little bit this year because based on what we would normally give out because of the COVID, our first priority had to be keeping Dublin Zoo, functioning. But we've a new director that has come in, Christoph, and he's very, very conservationally minded. So, you know, we're looking forward to continuing stronger links. And you know, the modern zoo now, I think the next real step for a zoo in terms of conservation is actually managing a part of the wild. And that's what I'd like to see. I mean, we do our breeding species, we support the projects, but Dublin Zoo needs to take control of, say, a part of India or Africa where we support the communities, you know, and let them to learn to live and cohabitate with animals, you know, protect the animals, provide rangers. So that's the next real step for conservation for me.
Wow. And is that likely to happen?
I think so. I think so. Yes. I think that all the zoos are realizing, you know, for their to be a real, it can't be just token conservation. It's got to be genuine conservation. And that means helping exactly in these, you know, where these people in the villages, like, you know, it's easy for us to say.
Because they need to be educated, yeah.
Exactly. It's easy for us to say, don't shoot the tiger. Sure. But if a fella shoots a tiger, he gets $100.
Yeah.
That's probably keep his family going for a whole year.
Yeah.
You know, but if we can go there and get them to sell, teach them how to make arts and crafts and sell them in your zoo shop. You know, there's a real link in there. So the role of the modern zoo has to be much more out there, you know, working with the communities, working with the people. And I definitely see that happening much sooner than we think.
I just think, so I know recently you were in the UK and one of my favorite programs, obviously we're going to talk about the zoo, the show. I love it. Half the time I'm crying, the other half I'm laughing because it's just such a mixed bag of emotions. But so when I'm taking my dog to the vet, I mean, I'm not going to lie, that it's like pandemonium in the back of the car. How do you even begin training an elephant?
It's a very simple process. You wouldn't believe. No, it's a very simple process. It's positive reinforcement. So basically, we don't have to share the same space with the elephants. We're one side of what's called a PC wall. PC wall stands for protected contact. So this wall is made from steel. It's got ports that you open for their ear, for their foot. But you initially stand there in front of the elephant. You have a bag of food in front of you, two sticks. So the elephant is in front of you. You touch his head with the stick. And you throw a piece of apple on the ground.
Oh, right.
He eats the apple. You touch the stick, or touch the head with the stick, you throw a piece of apple. So maybe after 8 or 10 goes, he says, he's kind of thinking, every time that stick touches my head, I'm getting rewarded here. This is not a bad deal for me. So then you can move away and you'll find the elephant will come with you. Touch the stick.
So intelligent.
And then you introduce it to different body parts. You know, we can ask them then, you know, we touch them to their foot and they actually present their foot out and they'll hold it there while I do the pedicure. Because in the wild, they'll walk great distances. We have it that we can do little tusk trims, or if they have a broken tusk, which is like a broken tooth, which we've had in the past, they allow us to flush it, clean it. And we take blood every week from their ears for testing, all because they're being rewarded. So you can't spring any surprises with an elephant.
Okay.
It's all about investment. And then they're kind of thinking, every time I go with the Jerry or the trainer, something good is going to happen.
So, and I'm assuming a huge amount of patience on your part, because if they don't want to do it,
it's all on their terms. You see, this is the deal with that type of training, Jen. It's all on their terms. And but they kind of make the right decision that's based on it for them. And they realize, hey, this is not a bad deal for me here. You know, I'm going to go in here because something good is going to happen. So you're creating this wonderful, you know, atmosphere of positivity. You know, and we have situations, as I said, we have these calves coming into what we call a calf creche area. And their moms can't.
Oh my God!
Their moms can't come in there. But but it's just to give us this access for veterinary care. And again, we have these babies that are coming into us less than a year old, and they're running in to be weighed on the weighing scales. And they lift up our trunk so we can take their temperature from their mouth. We can trim their tusks. We can check their eyes. We never separate them from mom. Mom comes over. You'd see her regularly coming over. She looks in the door. Baby's relaxed. Baby's getting fed. Everything is good. Then the mom goes back to her trainer. So the psychological wellness is paramount. And they always know that if I want to go back to my mom, I'll check in, I can. And that gives them that security. So they stay with you because they know they have that option.
I mean, to me, that just sounds like the best job in the world.
when you think of it, like elephants, previously up to this, elephants and are still treated like in the home countries where they come from, and even in certain zoos, it's called free contact, where you share the same space with the elephant and you use a hook or an ankus, and you become a dominant force. So the elephant understands, if I don't do or I don't conform here, there's a consequence. It's okay. Like a spike. And we just couldn't do that anymore. It's wrong. And there should be no consequence for an animal when you come into its world, only positivity. And now it is the key. You know,
when sure, it's the same with a child, really, isn't it? Exactly, I mean, if you're going to give them consequence all the time, it's just going to be a waste of time.
Exactly, Jen. Exactly. It's that positivity that they respond to. And that's what we do. Like we do with our apes. We can take... You know, rather than you come in and have to throw a net on top of them, and then you're kind of breaking trust. So we train them now to step on weigh scales. Our apes will present their shoulder for injections if they need, you know, if they have to be knocked out. So it's all about training, and that's what happened with the two elephants that I had over at Knowsley. They were Dublin born. We brought them to Knowsley Safari Park to quarantine before they went to Australia, and I spent many months training them every day to come in and out of the travel crate. They had to have a bracelet on their legs so they couldn't turn or hurt themselves. And then on the day of loading, they walked into the crate. We strapped them on the brace and said, that's it. And they were so happy. They were so comfortable that they actually went to sleep in the boxes on the way over. They lay down. So that's a real sign of their mental wellness and the preparation that we put into it. On their terms, no surprises, understanding and their welfare coming to the fore. Everything was that was possibly done for them to make it a successful journey.
And are they settled?
Absolutely brilliant. And that's the thing too, the commute, you know, when an animal goes, then we had keepers over with us at Knowsley. We've keepers that went over. I plan to go over again and see them, you know, in the future. And there's a constant exchange of information on how they behave and how they act and how they train.
And will they recognize you, Jerry?
Oh,
you...
absolutely.
Oh. You know, elephants they come to
are, you know, they're so smart. They're so smart. I've been with these guys since they were babies. Oh. You know, Kavi and Ashoka. And I've been with them since they were only, you know, I was here when they were born. And then, you know, to see them leave and you know, to be part of a, they're going to be part future bulls for breeding in Australia. And they've seen it all. You know, we can't teach elephants anything. The elephants learn from elephants. And that's why it's so successful in Dublin, because we have a matriarch, her sisters. It's a multi-generational related herd. And elephants teach elephants. One of the most amazing sights is when there's a birth here in the herd. It's just wonderful. And as new life tumbles to the sand floor, there's this absolute sounds of squeaks and trills and excitement, and the ears are flapping, and as the new baby, you know, falls to the sand, and every female, young female, is brought into witnesses to learn the sights, the smells, the sounds that are unique to that moment. So, you know, you can actually see the strategy with them, because they're teaching the next generation of elephants what to expect and learn. It's funny, the young bulls are pushed away because they've nothing to offer.
Yes.
The young bulls, by the time they're born, are destined to leave the herd.
Okay.
The matriarch and her daughter is the core of elephant society. But to see new life when it comes into their herd, and the excitement it brings, and the education that's been passed down from one elephant to the next. And that's why we were one of the first zoos in the world to use sand for elephants. And you see all the amniotic fluid is absorbed in the sand. The elephant, as it tries to climb and stand for the first time, gets great grip and traction. In the old days, they were kept on concrete floors. Mm. They need substrates that they can interact with. We create these big, massive sand pillows. It's like memory foam mattress for elephants. And they all snuggle in at night, and they all sleep together. And you see all our elephants in a big, big pile all on top of one another. They love to touch. They're tactile. They're smart. So they're a joy to be around. They really are.
And so what happens then? So obviously watching the show and all the rest... And that's amazing. I've seen the birth on the show. And of course, I'm in tears. What happens when there is a death?
Yeah, of course. I mean, like, you know, the show has been amazing for us, what it's done for us, because it was with our previous director, Leo Oosterweegel, and, you know, he felt we were ready to show. The show is 10 years going now. It's incredible.
Oh, God.
You know, and so, you know, yeah, so it's we're on to our 100th episode, which is incredible.
I cannot wait. Tonight is, I think, it's your last episode tonight.
That's right,
isn't it, for this season?
This one. And, you know, it's 100 episodes. But what people say to me is, like what you just said, it's like an emotional roller coaster ride. People, you know, because the thing is, the integrity and honesty of the show is there. It's not all about cute baby animals. You know, you've seen when, like, when there's one lioness we had that we looked after for years, Sheila. I looked after her from a young age, and Sheila had to be put to sleep because she was old. Because there's certain times in an animal's life where you have to make the correct decisions on their welfare. So, based with our veterinary team and our keepers, and we knew that her quality of life was compromised. So, we actually had to euthanize poor Sheila. She was over 20 years old, which is phenomenal age for a lion. For example, in the wild, they live to 8 years, 9 years, maybe.
Okay.
So, you know, the vet had. I was there, and the keepers, as she was euthanized and she took her very last breath of air. You know, we were all there. It was a very, very sad moment. That was recorded, shown on the TV. The very next day, it was incredible. There was thousands of emails came to the zoo saying, are the keepers okay? Nobody questioned our decision because they knew the love and the affection and the way we had managed the situation. So that's why the show is so incredibly successful, because it's an honest account of zoo life. Like, people ask me, they say, Jerry, well, what's the mortality rate at the zoo? Well, I said, it's 100%. Everything has to die at some point.
But
it's how we manage it, and it's the critical decisions that we made at critical times in their life. And then, you know, it's Shane Brennan and Moondance Productions that do it. They're friends of ours now. They're really, they come in and they're part of the family. And it's not like second take stuff. There's no action take.
Of course.
So it's as it is. And then you have this dynamic group of young keepers, you know, speaking from the heart and speaking about something they love, and there's an emotional.
Oh, you can so see it. I mean, my only wish is that it was longer than half an hour, because I love it.
Yes.
I sit down, I watch it, and I get like that, so invested in it and want to know what's going to happen. And then, you know, the happy bits are fantastic. I often cry at the happy bits, and then obviously the sad bits. But what happens, what do the animals do when there's been a death?
Well, it depends again on the species. Yeah. You know, if for example, an ape in an ape family died, like we had Lena and Harry, which were two of our founder gorillas. They were magnificent. Harry was a big favorite silverback for many, many years. So unfortunately, he had an aneurysm, and we didn't quite know what it was until the PM showed up. It was an aneurysm, like a brain hemorrhage. But when he died, when he died, it was incredible what the normal behavior. We allowed the rest of the troop to come in.
I wonder that. Did they get to see?
Yes, that's very important. Okay. It's very important for the acceptance of it. And it was very interesting. Like, there was a younger male that was coming up, and he kept pushing him, like to say, now, you know, like, it's my turn now, he's gone. And this is the natural behavior. And, you know, you allow them to have a mourning process, because, you know, what we do know now is the empathy and the emotional intelligence. And particularly with elephants, like, elephants are being recorded in the wild coming back to the spot where a herd member died, and where the bodies and touching the bones and spending a couple of hours standing there. Almost like they're visiting, you know, a funeral scene.
So it's like they're grieving.
They're grieving, exactly. So, you know, what we do know is they're talking about, like, you know, human rights, like, for apes now, you know, because of the Bill of Rights now for apes that's similar to human rights, because the pain, the suffering, all the consequences to their life that we taught so wrongly was just features that were or emotions that were, you know, good for humans. Well, that's not the case. Like, anything with a central nervous system can feel pain.
Of course.
And that's why, you know, we have such wonderful standards and ethics here at the zoo. And, you know, we have to make decisions with, like, as you said, we've seen on the zoo show, we had a macaque that lost her baby, and she carried her baby around for 2 days before she put it down. But we had to allow that.
Of course, yeah. Well, it's great that she allowed that, because
Exactly.
That's what would happen.
And exactly.
So, hard question. Which animal do you think is the most intelligent?
It's a difficult one. The apes are phenomenal. You know, the apes have, you know, they're problem solvers. They can figure it out. They're very, you know, they're like the apes, orangutans, chimpanzee, gorillas. They are what they are. Like, they're a primate. You know, they have that spindle neuron in the brain. They have that ability to rationalize. And, you know, you see chimpanzees in the wild, and they reckon that chimpanzees are, apart from man, are the only other animal that understands the consequence of murder, because they form militias. Like, you'll have militias of five or six males will come together. They'll identify a male from a neighboring group, and they go and they'll kill him, and they'll celebrate his death. And it's really, they'll mutilate him and pull off his genitals. This has all been observed in the wild, and almost celebrate the death. So, you know, like, the intelligence level within, and then, as I say, the elephants too, they're incredibly smart. You know, they're incredibly smart when you see them. But the primates, you know, are what they are.
And have you worked with all of them, all the different
animals?
Yeah,
absolutely. Like, I started off, as I say, as a young keeper, working with big cats, and then the elephants and apes. And then I became a team leader, which was for the far side section, which was all the big cats, all the apes, all the primates, and elephants. And then I became operations manager then. But you always get, like, a good keeper works for all the species. You need, yeah, you get an understanding for every animal here. And then you find your specialist ranges. But my advice, any young keeper coming in, is get as much experience as you can with as many different species, because every one of them has their own unique interest.
Sure. Is there an underestimated animal in the zoo? Is there an animal you can think of that doesn't get enough airtime?
I don't really think so. I think the reptiles get such a mixed view of them. People either love or hate them, and people just kind of react, "Oh, I don't like snakes," but they're fascinating creatures when you learn about their ecology and biology and the role they play. And so that's my point. I think, you know, read and learn before you judge.
Yes.
Everything, you know, it's all intertwined, you know, some way. All the species in some way interact, you know.
But in fairness, like, the keepers, because all of you can tell, you're all so passionate.
Yes.
And the reptile guy, I can't remember his name now, but Garrick, he comes across so passionate as well. So,
yeah, he's,
you know,
a great guy, yeah.
I remember David Attenborough, obviously, the king, doing a show on reptiles before. And it actually did. I kind of went, God, you know what? You're right. They're definitely not.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. You just learn that little bit about them and what they do. And because, as I say, everything in nature is tied in one way or the other. I mean, you have the big, you know, the flagship species, we'll say, that the people love, the giraffes, you know, the lions, the tigers. But, you know, learn a bit of, there is some fascinating.
Do giraffes ever lie down?
Yes, they lay down. They'll sit down quite a bit. We often come in at night and they don't fully lay over.
Because, okay.
But they get down and put their legs underneath them, and then they'll rest. And then, they have to sway their head and use their body and their neck like leverage to get back up again.
Okay.
But yeah, that's where we have a nice kind of a bark flooring for them.
Yeah.
Which retains heat and allows traction and grip too for the giraffes when they get
there. Do they all sleep?
Yeah, oh yeah, they will. They will. You'll see them go. They go fully asleep. Every all the mammals and all they need rest. Our elephants too. You know, we've done a very extensive sleep study. One of our keepers, Brendan Walsh, done it for nearly 2 years, and we were able to identify sleeping patterns, relationships within the herd. So, you know, so in the future, if we had to send off a couple of elephants or break a micro group away to start, which is what would normally happen in the wild, we look back. We do it scientifically and understand the relationships and the consequences of breaking up relationships. So it's all very scientific. And yeah, our elephants all sleep for anywhere between 3 and 7 hours per night. Never
wow.
Never for any longer than 1 hour in one spot, because they're so big. They have to keep displacing the weight around. But yeah, we have our nighttime cameras, which is great. I'd be sitting at home and I'd be watching in and looking at the animals on my phone. And then we have a system called Feed Pods, which is a remote controlled feeding system. And basically I can look in at the elephants. Oh yeah, they could do a scatter feed. And I send a text to this feed pod, and it throws out a scatter feed and it sends me back a text saying the elephants have been fed.
Fantastic.
I've actually done this. I've done this coming across the Atlantic at 22,000 feet. I checked in on Uplier Bull Elephant and was able to feed him. So technology is being harnessed, because elephants are either searching or looking for food for up to 18 hours a day.
How many calories does a freaking elephant eat? Yeah.
Well, not a lot, because you see, the thing is, it's mostly low nutritious. It's only a little under 2% of their body weight, but it's very low nutritious. Hay, bark, you know, leaf material, high fiber, and the digestibility is about 40%. That's why, like, their poo is practically hay coming back out. But we use it perfect for recycling and for growing more.
So it's all used. Brilliant! Wow!
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Oh my God! So their diet actually isn't that exciting.
No, it's not. Obviously, that's what they get 7 sets of teeth in their lifetime. And they're like blocks in the jaw. So it's called a molar eruption sequence. We'd often go in and find a big lump of tooth, but it's continuously growing because they're grinding down this massive fibrous diet into like a bolus, and then they would eat them and swallow them. So that's what they do. But yeah, they're like the branches as thick as your arm they eat and
wow.
break down. And it was incredible. You know, it's incredible what they're just high fiber, low nutritious. And that's why they have to eat such large amounts.
So what did all the cats eat then? I presume there's a lot of meat involved.
Yeah,
there.
Exactly. It's all certified meat. It's all passed for human consumption, you know, from poultry to the meats, you know. And then what we do is we would add a thing called a carnivore supplement, which is like a powder, and the powder's put on the meat. And that makes sure that they get all that. And we feed it with bone and that, you know, so they get the rip and tear. We tie it up. We have feed poles that they have to exercise. And you see the claws being used. And they're ripping and tearing. So it's a workout for them as well. And the same with the elephants again. again, we feed up, and, you know, rather than feed them on the ground, it's all gone in an hour, we put it up in a hay net, and it prolongs the feeding pattern, because that's what they like. They're weaving the hay out of this hay net that takes it, makes, and then we've timed boxes as well that open all during the night, giving them access. So, you know, the enrichment aspect of it is huge too. Like, you know, like some of the stuff that we do, like you could go into the lion habitat, for example, even a can of lynx, and we would spray some on the logs, and they come out and they're rubbing all over it, and they're trying to. So, you know, there's loads of ways of keeping them stimulated and enrichment. And another time, if I do the elephant's foot and I get a big pile of hard skin off an elephant's foot, we bring it up to the African hunting dogs and they go crazy for it. They're rolling in it and they're, you know, the scent of a smell of another animal. So you can use it for stimulation. So we're always looking for novel ways and ways to enrich their lives based on their biology and what they do. It's not silly stuff. It's not gimmicks. It's not like a circus. We do it for based on, like, if they run, well, we let them run. The elephants like to wallow, swim. We allow them to do all that. Our orangutan habitat, I'm sure you might have seen that, which is incredible. They're an arboreal species. They can climb over above the people.
Yes.
You know, we have trees, like artificial trees there, but in the middle of them trees, there's a lift for food. So the keepers pack the food in the morning, and it goes up and disperses food out into the branches, and they have to go through a puzzle feeder. So, you know, you're exercising their brain.
That's incredible. And this is obviously where all the money that's raised, this is where it's all going, which is fantastic.
Exactly. So it's keeping them busy.
When you're sending elephants or tigers or whoever off for breeding, what happens to the ones left behind then? Do they go through a grieving process, or is it done again kind of gradually?
It would depend. Generally, like, you know, there's a lot of species. Now, if they're family units, there can be difficulty, and for genetic reasons, you would have to. But with lions and like lions are very sociable, but males drift in and out. They're biologically programmed to drift in and out of prides or herds, like an elephant. So, you know, there is less of a consequence, you know, for them. And they like, nature has it that they grieve a little, or they might, but they get back to normality very quick, because it's either the integrity of the herd or the pack or the troop is what's more important, you know what I mean? So it's more important. But the decisions on are all not taken lightly. As I say, it's working with EASA, the stud book keepers, but ultimately, you know, it's all about genetics and keeping the gene pool as diverse as possible. That's what zoos are doing to ensure genetic, you know, viability and strength in the species.
Yeah. And so, okay, obviously we're in COVID, so everything has changed for now, but imagine COVID didn't exist. What's next for the zoo in terms of, are there any plans for future?
Yeah, well, I know what you're going to say. Yeah, we had been planning to do a whole new snow leopard habitat and for the red panda, a big rocky formation, like the cliffs that they are, the rock formations that they were living in the Himalayas. Unfortunately, that had to cease. But we're hoping when we get back operationally and effective again, and maybe next year we can complete that, because what we were doing every year, we were running at such a healthy surplus, we were able to invest a couple of million in constant projects to keep the public stimulated. Jurassic was one of the last one, or sea lions in recent years, or wolf pack last year got a new habitat. So, you know, what a lot of zoos are doing now, and particularly with Dublin, is less animals but more space. It's okay. Not about having the huge amount of animals anymore. You know, we have quality breeding programs, we're endangered species, but let's go for quantity of space. So that's what we're doing. You know, you look
and
at
do you think the do you think the Christmas lights will go ahead this year?
It won't, unfortunately.
Will it not? Okay.
Again, that's one of our casualties there. And again, that was taken in 5,000 people a night, and we have to follow guidelines. And back then, it was such an uncertain thing. Unfortunately, the decision was made not to go ahead with it, because it's a big financial investment for Dublin Zoo. Touch wood, we'll get back to it next year, because it was a wonderful experience too for people. It was so different and people loved it. You know, they loved that atmosphere of coming to the zoo. But unfortunately, again, it's another casualty of COVID.
Oh, God. What about you, Jerry? What are you thinking? What's next for you? I know you're obviously, you know, the zoo is...
Yeah, the zoo is obviously has been heartbeating for a long, long time now. And but, you know, I kind of am outgrowing the role here in the zoo, and I am looking more to the future with doing a lot more consultancy work. You know, I've been working with Cincinnati Zoo. They're about to embark on an $80 million project for elephants, and they want me to be the voice of the elephant on the project.
Wow. Oh, you'd be amazing at that.
It'd be amazing. And so that's what I'll plan to do, you know, and if, you know, the option, I've just been in discussions with the management here about that role, and they're very, they don't want me to leave, which is great. They said that if I make a decision that I want to do other things, they'll support me, but they want me to stay as an animal consultant here at the zoo too. So that means I can consult here at Dublin Zoo and then do my global work as well, because I get requests to travel to countries all over the world. I've been as far as China, Nanjing in China, setting up elephant training programs. They all want to do it the Dublin way. So it's an exciting future. And I thought long and hard about it, and I'd be very reluctant to leave Dublin Zoo because, as I say, it's been in my blood since as a kid. And so when I did spoke with the zoo, they said, no, hang on. Okay, that's great. We'd support you, but you need to stay as a consultant and come back so many days a year, you know, which would be brilliant. So yeah. It gives me a chance to expand my own business and my own profile.
You're a complete natural on the telly, I have to say.
Yeah, it's so easy, Jen, though. You're speaking from the heart. It's too easy, because, and then that's what people say. And I love communicating, whether it's three people, you know, walking around the zoo or 500 people in a room. I don't care. I just speak with the same passion and interest. And it's lovely, because of the new TV show, a lot of people recognize you. And all they want is 20 seconds of your time. And it's so easy just to be nice and say, how are you today? And have a quick word.
It's so important, the work you're doing. It's so important. And even to do this with me as well, I'm so appreciative because, you know, obviously you're so busy. And I know the last couple of weeks have been bananas.
Yeah, it's been crazy. But listen, I love telling the story. I'm very passionate about it. I'm very proud of it, the zoo. I'm very proud of our achievements. I have a wonderful team of keepers here. People that, you know, get up at all weather, come in. You know, as I say, for me too, for 36 years, I don't remember one day not wanting to come into work. Isn't that incredible?
Amazing. So,
you know, it's an amazing feeling. And I've seen that transformation.
Yeah.
I've seen the transformation. I know what it took to get us to this point. And that's why it was so brilliant that the support we got with our appeal, because people straight away, they realize that it's part of the fabric of Irish society. You know, the contribution that we made to education, conservation, 70,000 school children pass through our curriculum here every year. That's the importance of the zoo. And I love that role. I love going to schools. I love talking to kids. I've been to many schools, and they love hearing the zookeeper stories. And if I can inspire just one kid, then it's a job well done.
But there's just something about animals, isn't there? If I sit and pet my dog, I instantly feel
therapeutic.
Better.
Exactly. Yeah. It's exactly. So that's what happens when you're in their presence. They have that effect. I mean, we're just interlinked so closely with them, and they do such nice things to us. They make us feel. So that's why we have the people love the show, because of the drama. When something dies, they see the pain of the keepers. They see the hurt the keepers are feeling, and that's what animals do to you. Like this chimpanzee here, Betty, and she's 58 years old. My dad looked after her at one time, then I looked after her. She was originally where they used to years ago do the tea parties on the lawn. Thankfully, that's long since forgotten. But there's generations of keepers that have looked after her, you know. And I am actually dreading the day that she passes away, because that could happen anytime soon. That's a really, really
how
good
old
age.
Is she?
She's 58. She's 58. She arrived here in the early 60s from Sierra Leone, from an Irish missionary priest that had found them abandoned. Her three, Wendy, Betty and Judy, people would remember them from the lawn years ago. And Wendy passed away only a couple of years back too. But all my life, I've go up to her, I might see her for a couple of weeks. And when I go up to the house, she comes over and she's stretching her belly to me for the rubber belly.
Oh,
and
my
She's greeting me. She gives me a really warm greeting. You know, she said, good to see you again. Not being anthropomorphic, but that's how they do. They express.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah, they express. You know, I'd be thinking, wow, how lucky am I? How lucky am I? You know, and every time I'd be doing something unusual, I'd be standing there in the elephants, and I could be either doing a pedicure, and I'm actually saying, I know I'm the only person in Ireland doing that today.
Yes.
The only person.
It sounds amazing.
Do you know what I mean? And then you say, how wonderful is that, the uniqueness of what you're doing and forming these incredible relationships with these incredible animals? I just can't speak enough
and
about it.
How does one get a job in the zoo?
Yeah, well, education is an important feature of it now. Obviously, the zoology, you could do your zoology courses, but, Zookeepers aren't created in classes. That's what I will tell you. You know, you have to have that natural affinity. And then, you know, we've had a lot of keepers come in here on part-time work in the summer, picking up litter. It's a very important job. The zoo has to look well and tidy. And that's that traditionally was a very good feeding ground for future keepers. And then, you know, there is, if any young people want to have a look, go on to Sparshall College in Hampshire. Go on to their website and there is a zookeeping course can do that's very specific to the education of the modern keeper.
What's the name of that?
A Sparsholt College in Hampshire, Sparsholt, Sparsholt. Okay. And that's based in Hampshire. And a lot of our keepers, one of the things that we insist that they do this course, because it goes about nutrition, habitat maintenance, design, record keeping, all the aspects that are of the modern day that the keeper would need to function in his job. And it's not a usually academic course because, you know, there's a lot of practicality with it too, but that's the one that is considered to be the gold standard for entry into the zoo. You can either
It's not a 9-to-5 job either, so you need to be...
Yeah, no, that's it. Sure. I mean, honestly, you could be called in at any hour, whatever's happening, coming back to check on, you know, situations, sick animals, new animals coming in. It's definitely not 9-to-5. You know, it's definitely... Yeah. And of course, there's a lot of weekend work. You're out in all weathers, but I wouldn't swap it for the world.
Oh, it sounds like a vocation. So the fundraising, I'm assuming, is going to continue.
Yes, the support is incredible. We're going to continue our fundraising. You know, if people can continue to support us and give generously, it's great. It's www.dublinzoo.ie. That's what you can get on there. There's some great initiatives for schools and ideas that people can do to fundraise. And, you know, it's been, we're overwhelmed by the support. It's been brilliant. It's, you know, but it gives us a very valuable lifeline, hopefully, until we get back to the summer. And
oh, fingers crossed.
And, fingers crossed, but
as you say, you're talking $500,000 a month on food. So exactly, it has been amazing, but it has to keep going.
Exactly. We only have, you know, that gives us an extra 3-4 months, but we need, you know, the government hopefully will give us more support again. But
is there a worst case scenario? What happens if, ask?
We've had to discuss that and be planned that if it got to the stage that we couldn't open our doors again, what would happen? We would never euthanize animals, not at all. No animals are euthanized at Dublin Zoo unless it's based on health issues. But you know, we would have to work with other zoos. But you know, this is a global pandemic, and in many zoos across the UK and Europe and the US are closed also, and aren't making appeals. So it's a very difficult time. So you know, even though we would engage with all the necessary, you know, bodies that we really don't want that to happen, because we don't want any this situation lost on generations of people that get the opportunity to come to the zoo and understand and value the work that we do. So hopefully that is not the case. We're far more optimistic today than we were last Tuesday. And even, you know, we were, you know, they're talking about issues and, you know, unfortunately restructuring and redundancies. You have to make your business model work. Mm. But, you know, this gives breathing space. It gives us breathing space. It's not the end of our problems, but, you know, we're hopeful that, you know, this funding will get us to a point where we're back operational again and open and people are coming through our gates making their wonderful family memories.
Oh, fingers crossed. Is your own daughter going to follow in your footsteps, do you think?
She would be son Zach now. He's a real Mia was for a few years, but she's 14 now, you know. So you're just kind of a walking ATM at the moment. So you know, and these you know, you just, hi dad, can I have 20 euros? But you know, she's a wonderful kid and she's great fun and she loves animals. She's a great affinity, but she's drifting away. There's other interests creeping in, as you can imagine, at
Absolutely.
14. And it's fine. It's a cycle life. But Zach is great. He's animal crazy. He loves training his dog at home. He's got 3 snakes. You know, so he's shown some great skills towards animals, and he talks a lot about it. But I wouldn't, you know, we wait and see how it evolves. But what I do is make sure that they have a solid respect and understanding of nature and what it does and what it means, and to be kind to animals. And I think if you know, it's a very important feature for young children, because they find it easier to love animals first. And then, you know, I think that brings on the emotions for later on in life that prepare them for adulthood. So, you know, I think any kids that are around animals when they're young, you know, understand emotionally. I think it's really good for their emotions to develop, being around and understanding, you know, the love that a dog can give.
Definitely.
Definitely, yeah. It's definitely something that we should encourage, that's for sure.
Oh, amazing. Jerry, thank you so much, because I know you are so busy and we've been trying to do this for a couple of weeks now. I just want to say what you're doing. I love it. I think you're fantastic. I think you're made for television. So thank I can't you. Wait to see what's going to happen in the next few years with you.
Oh, thanks, Etienne. I'm excited about my future. And, you know, people have been so wonderful. They've given me great support, great encouragement.
And you deserve every bit of it. You deserve. You all do. All to all the keepers. You all do. I just think I can't wait till tonight's show now. I just wish it was going to be on next week.
Brilliant.
Are you filming a new another one?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah, we were talking with Shane the other day and we're planning to continue for a couple more years. The appetite is there for it. You know, it's doing very well in the ratings. It gets over 25% when of the pop, you know, brings in 250,000, 300,000 viewers every week when it's on. You know, it's getting rerun. It's going all over the world now. It's actually in like one of the number one shows in Belgium. Like, I have people that come to the zoo from Belgium would stop you and say, you want to talk to you. It's going to the States on some of their channels over there. So, like, I reckon it's an audience of over 150 million people. You know, you got this little zoo in Dublin, in Ireland, and the impact that we're having. And like, people just love what we're doing because they see the care and it's worth it.
But it's real. It's so real. I mean, when one of you are upset, I'm upset. When you're happy, you're happy. It's just, it's amazing. It's amazing.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Jerry, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Shall we do an update again soon?
Definitely, definitely.
Cool.
Cheers. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Anne. Take care.
Cheers, Jerry. Bye.
Bye-bye.